Good evening, everyone. Please be comfortable. Our koan for this retreat, the story of the true Qian, is an old myth. And like all myths, it's a story that speaks to something deep inside of us, something about what it's like to be human. This myth is also, well, it's many things, but one of the things is it's about what it's like to live a divided life, which is something that I think many of us can feel our way into. And it's also about what it might be to find healing and peace and wholeness among these divisions. So this evening I want to offer some very practical advice, grandmotherly, grandfatherly advice on how we can work with our own divisions in meditation, and how we might find wholeness even right in the middle of those divisions. How we can wake up from the trances that can dominate our awareness, the stories, the repetitive ruminations, fantasies, coulda, shoulda, wouldas, unworthiness, and how we can wake up into the great dream of the world. Like Qian in the story, we all have a part of ourselves that goes forth into the world and does what needs to be done. We work, maybe we take care of people close to us, we do the laundry and the dishes, we take care of our communities. And yet there may be a part of us that feels sick in bed, a part that is suffering, exiled, lonely, scared, full of shame. So I think it's a question for each of us. What are the parts of your life that you think you need to renounce? In Joan's Vimalakirti book, she says, Vimalakirti subverts anything that reinforces our tendency to make two, to divide things up into this pile and that pile, us and them, black and white, right and wrong. Dualism is a trick of the mind, never a description of the way the world actually is. If we can subvert the habits of mind that make dualities, we can then take the next step, which is to begin to connect those things that have been separated by that trick. And this koan invites us to reconcile dualities, as Qian does when each of the two Qians melt into the other. So she lives two lives. Each has its own suffering and its own life. Walt Whitman in Song of Myself says, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." And it's one of the things we definitely notice in meditation is our multitudes and our contradictions. We notice that we're kind of compulsively telling ourselves stories about ourselves and the world, the way things are, the way we are. And often the stories are not good. They're stories about problems. Or sometimes they're fantasies about the road not taken. Or maybe the way that we hope things could be. So rather than dreams, we could think of these as trances, fixations. They tend to loop endlessly, you may have noticed. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have a little jukebox in our brain with about 10 songs on it. And they get pretty old. And when we sit here like we're doing in this retreat, we can't look away. We see how much they dominate us. So what do we do? If these loops, these fixations, are persistent visitors, the first thing is to greet them with warmth and curiosity. Usually we just want to get rid of them. We want to X them out, or just sort of get to that happy place, you know, the better place, be in the Tao. But then they just come back and bite us in the butt. So it's really helpful to actually greet them, greet these stories, greet these fixations. And maybe you could ask it a few questions to get to know it, because maybe you actually don't know it. You think you do, you know, because it's so loud all the time. But one really good question is this voice trying to protect you? Is it trying to help you? Is it trying to anticipate and head off problems? If so, then really honestly thank that part that's doing that. It's doing hard work on your behalf, tirelessly, you know, repetitively. So you can thank it for its service and really feel that, you know, feel gratitude, be aware of how much there's an attempt, maybe a little misguided, but it's trying to help. And that, it really needs that recognition. And then you can let it know that you're here in Sesshin. It's a specially designed environment to be safe, to be without impingements as best as we can. And all of these hypervigilant, you know, parts of ourselves can start to relax. Another question is this voice a very young part of yourself that's in distress? We all have these parts too, I think. The part that's caught up in fear or shame. If that's something that you recognize, picture this young part of yourself. See its age, really see it, you know, and ask it what it needs to feel safe. And see if you can offer that. For my, you know, I have a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old, they're kind of friends, and I just like to pull them onto my lap. They need that, you know. They need comfort. They need reassurance. They need contact and recognition. And it's amazing how just that little move can open up a lot of space. And again, you can remind those young parts of yourself that it's safe here and that maybe they can soften back for a while. At the end of the koan, Qian says, I never realized I was still at home. And it's true, when we're lost in our trance, we forget that we are already home, that we've always been at home. It's not something we've lost. Actually, it's always just so close, we can't believe it. And when we welcome and value all of those parts of ourselves, then we can invite them to notice that it's okay. We can relax, we can soften, and then something can start to shift. But for me, I need to do these steps first, and then something can open up. So I'm giving you some very hard won helps that help me. And in that those moments, we are like the two Qians that are embracing and melting into each other. So again, practically speaking, how do we make this shift from these jabbering voices and these distressed young parts and these parts that are always trying to get things right, not make mistakes? And how do we move from that and shift into wholeness? Joan talks about making ourselves fetchable, so that the call of the owl or the magnificent verticality of those ponderosa pines can bring us into their dream. But first, we have to unhook from that tight little whirlpool of our own small mind. So again, here's a move that helps me just to make that first shift. There's an initial shift. So I invite you to really take up this question with me. What's here now when there's no problem to solve? Feel the qualities that arise that can help us pretty quickly shift from that trance into something really different, really bigger. Who's aware now when there's no problem to solve? So these questions, I think, might help us wake up from the trance of the small mind, the limited parts of the self that are on repeat, and shift into awareness that is the boundless ground of being. And that's a really good place to meet your koan. And this is the place, that boundless ground, what's here now, when there's no problem. That, you know, all of our teachers and our ancestors and the poets have written about, because it's so inspiring and so hard to describe. Hakuin Zenji said, "The formless form comes into form. Going and coming, we are in the right place." This is the right place. Tori Zenji said, "Things can't help but shine with this light." It's a quality that I notice in this ground of being. is that the light is everywhere, equally. There's no place that it isn't. Things can't help but shine with this light. Anywhere you cut it, it's gold. There's nothing else. This is the quality of awareness, of just innate compassion. We don't have to try to be compassionate. It's innate. We find it right there. And this is what we sing in Kanzeon: eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. And it's so lovely to see the ways that people have tried to describe this. It's inspiring. Julian of Norwich said, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." St. Francis of Assisi said, "What we are looking for is what is looking." Meister Eckhart said, "The eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me." So we can step in at any moment. We can make this shift. We can shift into this awareness that's not personal. We share it equally with the mud and the spiders and the warblers, and we also partake of it. And from here, from this awareness of this ground of being, we can wake into the dream of the world. So we're kind of waking up from a trance and waking into a dream, and an embodied and interconnected feeling of flow, and knowing that we're at home. We can effortlessly embody that interplay of form and emptiness as we live into our place in the great dream of the world. In Joan's new book, Forests Through Forests of Every Color, she has a section on a chapter on the dream. She says, "It's a venerable Buddhist idea that life is a dream. Scientists of dark matter and energy tell us that the dark makes up about 96% of the universe. That being the case, we might imagine the visible universe, Shitto's streaming branches of light, as the dream of the dark, or what ancestor Ma meant when he called the universe the samadhi, the deep meditation of Dharma nature. The koans have an unorthodox view, though. As we awaken, we aren't waking up from the dream, but into it. You might say that our lives are illusory, meaning that we're delusional, unreliable, or even dangerous. Or you can say that they're dreamlike, fluid, mutable, many-layered, and good for challenging the solidity of fixed ideas, the edges of the self, and the boundaries between states of consciousness, our attachments to things we think as we think that they are, or as we want them to be, or as we think we are. It's good for holding things provisionally, for imagining things differently, for taking ourselves as a little less inevitable." So when we wake into the dream, we can ask questions like Chien's. She said, "Now I can't tell which one I really was, the one who went away or the one who stayed home. And it's not a question that we really need to answer. It's not one, it's not two, it's all of it. And we can enlarge ourselves past the boundaries of our skin, past the boundaries of who we think we are. We're so much bigger than we know. And we find a whole world of possibility. I told a couple of you today in work in the room that I'm imagining all of Qian's other lives. We only heard about two. I've spent the day imagining her as Amelia Earhart and also Emily Dickinson, because I think she needs to do something besides lay sick or take care of people. And Emily Dickinson said in one of her poems, "I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous for windows, superior for doors." We can live all of these lives, all of our lives, all of the coulda, shoulda, woulda lives, all of the lives that we read about, all of the people in the koans, they are us. There is no other. And that is good news. We can feel ourselves living into that as we let ourselves get big and weird. Here's another poem by Emily Dickinson, my muse of the day. "We grow accustomed to the dark when light is put away, as when the neighbor holds the lamp to witness her goodbye. A moment, we uncertain step for the newness of the night. Then fit our vision to the dark and meet the road erect. And so of larger darkness, those evenings of the brain, when not a moon disclose a sign or star come out within. The bravest grope a little and sometimes hit a tree directly in the forehead. But as they learn to see, either the darkness alters or something in the sight adjusts itself to midnight and life steps almost straight." So what's it like to step into the possibilities when that world is not clear? It's dark, we don't know. Those top 10 hit parade on the jukebox, we know that. It gives us a shape, it gives us an identity, it tells us who we are, and it keeps us small. When we step into that midnight with no moon and no star, even the neighbors gone, we don't know what's going to happen. And it can feel like a free fall. Can we trust that? Can we let ourselves be that big? And what happens then? Walt Whitman said, "I too am not a bit tamed. I too am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world." So I would love to hear all of your barbaric yawps.
Yawp!
Yeah. Yeah. It's the sound of freedom. And that freedom is right here. It's nowhere else. You don't have to do anything. It's just a little shift. Just that little shift. So the project, one of the projects of retreat, is to enlarge the self. Because like Qian, we often feel so divided, so partial, so insufficient. And we gather all of the parts and stories that have been exiled. And we can allow them to gather around, and we can offer them thanks. They probably were helping us survive at some point. They just got like one of those, remember records when they would skip? It's like that. They just start skipping. And then, like Qian, we find the self that is larger than those partial versions. And from there, we can shift into the profound freedom of the formless form and participate in the great dream that we are all dancing through all the time. Our project is to get really good at making that shift. We make it over and over. We just keep making it. We fall back and we shift in. We fall back and we shift into freedom. And at some point, those shifts just start to kind of weave together and they become kind of an expanse, a field of liberation. And it becomes so natural that it's just like putting on your shirt or crawling into bed at night. It's a natural movement that we make over and over as part of our awakening together. And Qian can be our muse and our guide. And we can dream her dream on, dream ourselves in, and even explode that container, subvert it, explode it, and then reconnect. We connect with each other, as Martha so beautifully said, as the caterpillar that we are. As we do this together, we know we're not alone. And maybe we're not even different, as the Wu Men's comment says, not one, not two. Is it one? Is it two? Yes. Thank you all. And I'd be happy for any questions or conversation.
I feel you've given us such a bounty, such a feeling of abundance. Mm-hmm. I just want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you, but it's not anything I gave you.
You reminded us.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's the cornucopia is right here. Yeah. Yeah, hi, Ellen.
So earlier today, you asked me, "What would it be like to meld the disparate parts?"
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to share that with everybody because it's such a generative question.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I think what you just did was you really amplified this story and really. Well, in a very Zen way, you know, it was very helpful because, you know, we could get stuck in the story.
And we do.
And we do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm always, this story always astounds me for its sophistication, its psychological sophistication. So to hear you, you know, enlarge it like that, amplify it, is very helpful.
Yeah, good. Thanks. Yeah, and I think that melding together, it's not just creating one whole person, right? It's expanding the whole field. So I think that what happens, you know, at the denouement there of the story is something, it's pretty cool, and it can happen to us. It's something we can experience, you know, when we bring it all together and then we kind of step out of our own way. When we just stop trying to fix and solve and be good, you know?
Say there was such a sweetness in the when you said, you know, when there is no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, you know, that especially the maybe the last third or half of the talk brings me to my. Climate anxiety.
Uh-huh.
You know, that I,
yeah.
That people are probably getting tired of hearing about.
Yeah.
Perhaps. But,
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the big problem, right? I mean, that's the maha problem. Yeah. And it is a problem. And yet, right? And, you know, I've been sort of learning a little bit about just contemporary neuroscience and really they're finding, you know, just we're mammals, basically, and what our brains are pretty sophisticated prediction systems. We're trying to, you know, determine what's going to happen next for survival. I mean, that's just what all mammals need to do. And we base that on the past experience, usually. And so it's a really, you know, normal, healthy survival instinct. And so we're always looking for the problem. And our life is, you know, the problem is fill in the blank. What am I going to do? How am I going to fix it? How am I going to solve it? What are people going to think? You know? What about the future? What's going to happen next? It's just what we do. It's not, I mean, that's part of Qian, right? That's part of the family. It's part of the family way. And we can gather it in. Welcome. No exiles. And yet there's something bigger, thankfully, right? Mm-hmm. Even when there's climate anxiety, there's even something bigger than that, amazingly enough.
That makes me think about Maitreya Buddha, you know, the Buddha to come, and what's the thing that's even bigger than we've even seen?
Yeah.
I was reading some Buddhist magazine recently, I can't remember, it might have been Thich Nhat Hanh. Somebody was talking about the Sanghakaya. I just loved that. That seems to me what Maitreya Buddha is. And that's like...
The Sanghakaya?
Sanghakaya.
Isn't
that awesome?
Wow, yeah. That's so lovely. Yeah. Right, because that's when we make that shift, right? When we shift into that ground of being, one of the things, the qualities that I taste is connection.
Yeah.
That it's just, it's all connection, right? Not even connection between things, it's just connection, mm-hmm. right? And that's the Sanghakaya. We're living into that, we're feeling into that together. We're doing that together. And that is such a gorgeous thing to be able to do. So I love that, thank you.
Could you talk a little bit about what the Sanghakaya is, to kind of fill that out?
Oof. I mean, I don't think I know. I think that's something really for us to discover together. You know, it's something, it's not like a thing with the definition, as far as I can tell. It's mm-hmm. like a lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's the experience that I think we're having together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's one of the remarkable things. I mean, we can have a Sanghakaya on Zoom, you know, as we have, but being here together and really feeling the energy, feeling really viscerally that we all help each other, we hold each other's practice, we support each other. And I mean, of course, all of the jobs that we do, the ways that we contribute to our ability to have the retreat, but then just in the sitting and the ways that, you know, I'm carried along by your practice. I'm carried along by the awareness of interdependence and interconnection, but that I know that we all have. So it's like Indra's net. It's this incredibly vast, beautiful web of interconnection. And I'm sure it's so many other things, and I really, you know, I invite you to feel, you know, what it is for you. What's it like? And I think maybe we're all having, you know, a little boost of the vividness, you know, to be together.
Mm-hmm.
We don't take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
We can really palpably feel it. And that is a full and complete expression of the great matter. Even when that person's being annoying, you know? Or even when you think you've made a mistake and blew it. You can't fall out of the web of the Sanghakaya, you know? Thankfully.
Megan, on a really practical note, could you maybe just say a little bit about what Kaya means?
Sure. So I think that this is a play on the three kayas, or the three bodies of the Buddha. For people who may not be familiar with this terminology, it's a traditional teaching that there are three bodies of the Buddha. The Dharmakaya, right, is the body of the vastness. The Nirmanakaya is the body of form. And then the Sambhogakaya is the dream, you know, the dream in which we live, you know. And so this is maybe, you know, just like Qian has lots of lives, you know, we can add lives. We can maybe add kayas. And Martha and via maybe Thich Nhat Hanh or somebody is adding the Sanghakaya, the community. And it's not just us, right? It's the frogs and the crickets and the birds and the pines and the spruce and the clover.
And the fans and the light bulbs.
Yes. Yes. There's nothing that's not in the Sanghakaya. All of the kayas contain everything, right? And they're all true all at once. All of the above.
You know, maybe you said, I think you said at some point, I think when I used to think about this stuff, I would try to imagine like it kind of being inside me.
Mm-hmm.
But then you just said something about it being like, actually, that's not, you know, you can be connected, but also it's outside of you too.
Oh yeah.
And I think you said that in your speech somewhere. Anyway, that really opened up for me, because then it did feel like, oh, you know, like I don't have to be everywhere all at once or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely. Mm-hmm. Thanks. You know, the funny little image that I always have about this is, I don't know if you guys remember the old animated show of When the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And you remember at the end, like he's got this teeny tiny little heart, right? And his heart starts to grow, and they have like a mag. It's so little at first, they have to put a magnifying glass on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And at some point, like it explodes the magnifying glass. So I feel like that is, there's this moment when we sort of cross over from being in our little skin bag, right? Our little small self. And we just explode the magnifying glass, and we feel our largeness, the multitudes. And it's all inside and all outside, and it's all crazy mixed up. And we can just play there.
I recently had the opportunity of being on a nature retreat where I was alone for 24 hours, and what I came to realize was that not that just that I was observing and in it, but that I was being observed. And I had, you know, there were three different encounters that if I had not been spending that much time doing nothing, I would not have even recognized. And one was a butterfly that left the meadow to come visit, and another was a moose with her young one who passed by and nodded at me, and I nodded back. And a third was a hummingbird, who, as I was trying to break camp, who kind of like came out of absolutely nowhere and circumambulated the space that I was in, yeah. And kind of then disappeared. And I was just left me feeling this interconnectedness in a way that I realized I rarely give myself the opportunity to experience, even though it's always there.
Yeah.
And that I felt known by the place I was in, yeah. Rather than observing and trying to figure it out.
Yeah, that's so lovely. Thank you for that, Phil. It's when it's like the tables are turned, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like when the well sees the donkey.
Exactly.
And the whole question of subject and object gets kind of strange. And maybe something is, the field is so big that it's not even about subject or object. It's just the play, the dance, you know, in the meadow. Not one, not two. Any other last?
On the second, the part about, you know, welcoming,
mm-hmm.
unconditional love. It's like magic to me.
Yeah.
A healing kind of, just so healing.
Yeah, if I just thank you, Jen. And I think, you know, we can be at risk sometimes in Zen of, you know, kind of what we call spiritual bypass. We just want to get to the spiritual part and kind of leave all our troublesome, the parts of ourselves behind. And I think we really can get into trouble with that. And so for me, and just for my own practice, something really changed when I was able to, instead of just ditching, which I think was in some ways, you know, not the only reason I came to meditation, but it was my sort of hidden agenda maybe, you know. But when I could turn towards those parts of myself, the parts that are, you know, trying to help me survive, and the parts that are just young and upset, you know, and just kind of chronically, and to just really, like, give them some love, gather them in, and sit there, sit from there. Don't try to rise above it, you know, sit right there. That's the starting place, and from there you can start to shift. You don't get to ditch it, though. Thank you all.